discussing Jacob fleeing after being with Laban and his family for 20 years in Haran. He finds out that the sons and the father aren't having the same opinion of him as they had before because he's flourishing and they're not. God tells Jacob to return home, so he leaves. While Laban is away shearing sheep, it describes he took advantage of that moment and heads back to the land of Canaan. They describe Rachel stealing some of her father's idols, and that Laban finds out about that they had been gone on the third day that he was away. After that, he gives chase. It says it takes him about 7 days to catch up with them in the mountains of Gilead. Laban accuses Jacob of stealing those idols. Jacob has no idea what he's talking about, so he tells him, go ahead and search our entire company. If you find somebody that has it, you know, let him die. He didn't know Rachel was the one that took him. Laban searches through all the tents, doesn't find anything. And then after that, Jacob kind of rebukes Laban for pretty much the last 20 years. He kind of goes off, not only about that accusation about the idols, but pretty much what he considers mistreatment over the entire time that he was in the land of Haran. Jacob and Laban make a covenant at this point that they would not harm each other in the future. It talked about them heaping up the stones and that they would not harm each other. Laban at that point kisses his family, blesses him, and returns back home. After that, we get into this meeting with Esau, and Jacob finds out that Esau is coming with 400 men, and it creates great fear. And you got to remember what happened was the birthright and the blessing that he stole, and that's what's on his mind. 20 years had passed, but he's like, why is he coming with 400 men? You know, in his mind, is he coming to make war with me? Is he coming to kill me? So moving on from that, Jacob decides to divide his company for protection. He says if they attack one company, maybe the other one can get away. And then he smartly goes to God in prayer at that time, praying for deliverance from Esau. We discussed Jacob just gathering a massive amount of a gift of many animals, depending on your translation, calling them droves or herds or flocks, of all these animals that he's going to give as a present to Esau to kind of show him, you know, I respect you and, you know, I'm sorry for what's been done, but here is all this stuff. So he tells his servants to tell Esau those presents are for him and that to say that Jacob's behind us. Then we get into this story about wrestling with God. It starts out by saying while preparing to face Esau during the night, Jacob wrestles with a man until daybreak. Jacob calls that place Peniel, also pronounced Penuel, but it means the face of God. And at this time, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. So very important in there, and that means he who struggles or strives with God. And it said that, you know, he prevailed. Moving on from there, now you have the meeting coming, commencing at this time. Esau's getting closer with his 400 men, so Jacob is preparing that. He separates his wife and his children together. He presents the concubines first with the children born through them, and then Leah next. And then finally, Rachel and Joseph. Joseph would been about 6 years old at this time. Says that he bowed seven different times before Esau, before they met. And then at that time, you finally have the expectation they're really about to meet, and he still doesn't know what's going to happen. But verse 4 of that chapter says, but Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. So you didn't have revenge. What you have is brotherly love. So after 20 years, even though Jacob was very worried about what was going to happen, you know, Esau shows kindness to him when they meet each other. He obviously missed his brother. And then at that time, it says Jacob and Esau separate. And, you know, Jacob, it looks like Jacob's going to follow Esau to Mount Seir, but he doesn't. So Esau heads back to his land, but Jacob stays in that area right there in Succoth. And you see on the map there about where that number 2 is up on the map. You'll see a lot of those places we just talked about, Succoth. Penuel, Mahanaim, all those around the Jabbok River. Okay, getting into today's lesson, starting, again, this is just the last couple of verses of 33 and then getting right into 34. It starts out saying in chapter 33, verse 18, "Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city, and he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money." I think some translations may say silver. "Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel." So we have Jacob now moving on to this area of Shechem. This is going to be a city, and there's also going to be a character here that we get into that has that name, but it's also the city that we're talking about. This is a place where God had given the promises to Abraham back in chapter 12 when he was given the promises. We talked about that at this place here. He buys a tract of land here, and as far as what we have recorded, this is the second time that land has been bought by Abraham and his descendants. The other time was the cave of Machpelah for burial. So you have this one being bought for 100 pieces of money, and just as a reference point later that you can look up on your own time, but in Joshua, it describes that Joseph would be buried in this tract of land that we're talking about here. So that's just a little bit about that area. So in verse 20, Jacob builds an altar there to God, calls it El Elohe Israel. That's God, the God of Israel. So again, this Shechem is not only a man that's a main character in this story in chapter 34, but it's also the name of this place where Jacob built the altar here. Okay, starting chapter 34, reading a couple of verses here. "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her." So let's talk a little bit about what age Dinah is. We don't really know. It didn't say right there that she's this age, but we have a little bit of stuff where we can guess about what age she is. Let's recall that we know that Joseph is 17 when he's sold into slavery. She's about the same age as him, maybe a little bit older. There's 11 years between them leaving Haran and Joseph being sold into slavery, because he's sold at 17 and was 6 when they leave. This event that we're talking about in this story in chapter 34 would be a couple of years before Joseph is sold into slavery, because as we'll see as we go into the next couple of chapters, the family still has to leave from where this story is, go down through Bethel, and then they're making their way eventually towards Hebron or Mamre. So all that has to happen in that travel and where they're at. And that story takes a little bit of time. So as far as a guess, we can get pretty close, but it is a guess, but it's a close guess. We also got to remember the older brothers must be old enough to smite the men of the city. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. That's the story we're getting into in chapter 34. Kids, 12 and 13-year-olds, wouldn't be able to do this, so they'd have to be a little bit older. Reuben would have been about 12 when Jacob meets Esau in the story that we just got through. And Simeon and Levi would be a year or so younger than that. So if we say about 9 years or so after this meeting had taken place of this 11 years, if 9 more years would pass, Esau would be somewhere around 21 or so. And Simeon and Levi, who are the main characters in this story here, would be around 20 or 19, somewhere in that right there. So they would be grown in size at this time, and their sister would be somewhere around 16. She could be a little bit younger. She could have been a little bit older. Age isn't super important, but she wasn't a grown woman either, which is important in the story. Okay, so moving on a little bit from that point. So she goes out, it says, to kind of see the other girls in the land and that sort of stuff. She kind of wants to get out and do some sightseeing and go into the city. When she goes there, obviously it doesn't describe anybody else being with her. Her brothers, it's going to say, were out in the field. Don't know where Jacob was exactly at the time, but for whatever reason, she ends up being by herself and is going to do that. This predator, Shechem, where it describes here in verse 2. Look at how it says in just this one sentence. He saw her. In other words, he lusted after her right there. He saw her. He took her forcibly, it seems. He lay with her. It says he violated her, depending on your translation there. So she goes to see, and then while she's going to see, somebody is watching her, stalking her, as she's in that area alone with no protection. Shechem was strongly attracted to Dinah, it says in verse 3. The scriptures talk about him loving her and speaking kindly to her. But we need to remember, it doesn't matter that this, and that's kind of how he wants the story to go. If he was to write it, this is what he wants to probably describe himself as. But that doesn't take away the great sin he committed and how he violated her. But it seems to be after this, he really wanted her as a wife. And it says some of this about his character. But verse 2 kind of says a lot about his character as well. Shechem tells his father, get me this young woman as a wife in verse 4. Again, the brothers are away in a field. Jacob finds out about this, but he decides not to really do anything about it yet till his sons come in from that, it says in verse 5. When the brothers find out, it describes them as being very angry and grieved about this. They say such a thing ought not to be done in verse 7. And this is going to really, you know, it goes from just minor anger to, you know, as it's building up, wrath and a scheme of vengeance that comes out of this from them. So Hamor, who's Shechem's father, comes in to speak to Jacob and his sons. It describes in verse 8 through 10, he says, our son longs for your daughter. He wants them to intermarry. Let us have her. We want just your daughters to marry people in our land. You know, you can take our daughters. We want all this. Let's be one people sort of thing right here. So almost everybody's covering up kind of what happened. There's really nothing being said about it other than let's just, you know, have marriages and combine our peoples. In verse 11 and 12, down in that area, Shechem, the son who violated Dinah, offers great gifts at this time. He pretty much says, I'll give you whatever you want. Just ask the price and just let me have the young woman. I'll give you whatever you want, he says. The brothers reply, and it's important here to know this is deceitfully. They say this plan. They're going to tell the Hamor and Shechem, they're going to tell them something, but they have no intention of actually doing what they say at that point. Their intention is to get revenge. So deceitfully, and it says deceitfully because he defiled Dinah in verse 13, they put one condition. They say, okay, we'll allow all this intermarrying to be done. You can have Dinah as your wife, but all the men of the city must be circumcised as we are. And he says, else, if you don't agree to that, we're going to take our daughter and we're going to be gone there in verse 17. Moving on for there, Hamor goes back, him and Shechem go back into the city, and they go give this plan of, you know, trying to get all the men of the city to agree. You know, we want Dinah as my son's daughter, and so you're going to have to be circumcised. They go, they're like, they're at peace with us now. Let them dwell, let them trade, let them live among us. Let us share our daughters with each other. Let us be one people. And down in verse 22, he tells them about that one condition. All men must be circumcised. But then look at this kind of greedy comment right here and all this right here that they say. He tries to convince them in by saying, look what you're going to get out of it too. This isn't just for my son. Look at this. Will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours in verse 23. So greed kind of overtakes the men of that city there. And they're like, yeah, that sounds good to us. We'll do it. So all agreed and they all get circumcised, it says there in verse 24. Okay, down around verse 25, let's read a few verses there. It says, now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. So it pretty much describes as, you know, as we would know, they were in a lot of pain. And that you see now what they meant by saying they were acting deceitfully in verse 13. It was part of their plan to get this to happen because they knew these men were going to be in no condition to really fight back at this point. So it describes them being in pain the third day. And Simeon and Levi is going to be the two brothers here that actually conduct the attack. Again, we're guessing they're somewhere around 20 or so years old. They killed Hamor and Shechem and all the men of the city in verse 25 and 26. They get their sister back. They totally plundered the city as we just described, taking all their wealth. And they even took captives of the children and the wives. Now, once Jacob finds out what the brothers actually did, he's not very happy about it. It describes there in verse 30 and 31 that he is very troubled over their slaughter of all those men there. And he tells his son that they've caused trouble for the family. He's worried that the people, the Canaanites and the Perizzites in the area are going to find out about this attack. And then they're going to kill Jacob and his family over it. So he's very upset that he feels like they didn't handle the situation that maybe should have been handled, but should they have gone in and wiped out the whole city? It seems that he's very much questioning what they did and that he didn't really give them permission to do what they did. But he's worried about their household being destroyed. But then finishing up this story right here, the sons respond to him. I guess they're in kind of shock that their dad's acting this way after what happened to Dinah. And they said, talking about Shechem, should he treat our sister like a harlot? In other words, without punishment. They try to justify their actions because of the great sin that Shechem did. So it leaves us, we're not told a whole lot. God doesn't come in and tell us any more than what we know here. Jacob's opinion was they went too far with their vengeance here. Seems like they're kind of out of control and he's not there and he's worried about what's going to happen. But this gets into another one of those, I guess, lessons to us about the end justifying the means. It's not okay to use sin to try to make a sin right, you know, a sin that's already happened right there. But I know we're humans and we can understand Dinah was violated and something happened to our daughters or our sisters or our family member like that. We would be grieved and a lot of people would be thinking vengeance immediately. As Christians, we got to have self-control. And it looks like Jacob kind of gets onto them because they kind of go off in just a state of wrath here. So that city is kind of up there, what is circled in the map right there. And they're going to be leaving that place and kind of heading south from there to some other places that we'll talk to in the next part of the lesson. So that's it for chapter 34. Are there any comments or questions on chapter 34? Yeah, so Brent's bringing up the point that when we get later to what Wayne will be teaching later, that when Jacob's giving blessings and describing his sons, when he's given blessings, and we got another son we'll talk about in a little bit about that point too, but he described them as instruments of cruelty, you know, when he's getting later in years, when he's talking about each of his sons right there. So these are acts that stuck in his mind as definitely not acting righteously in this right here. All right? Anything else? You know, we can act in a way that's righteous and zeal, or we can act in a way that's totally out of self-control, which seems like here. But, you know, this one's almost on another level because it's not like this wasn't one of those immediate, go do it right now. It stuck with them for several days and kind of built up because they allow their plan to, you know, come to fruition and a few days goes by to where, I mean, they don't relent on what they had planned right off the bat and they stick with it. So, yeah, there's some lessons for us in there. All right, let's get into chapter 35. read a few verses here and then we'll move on with summarizing a lot of it. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. Verse 5, and they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. That's what we were just talking about, that Jacob was worried about. Verse 6, so Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him, and he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth tree. So the name of it was called Alon Bakuth. So let's summarize some of that. So it starts out, so God comes to Jacob again. He directs him, I want you to go to Bethel. So they're up at Shechem. He said, you need to leave. You need to go to Bethel. Jacob gets with his household, and he's telling them pretty much to prepare yourselves, clean yourselves, mind and body. So you see there, and this is one of the confusing things that's in there, but obviously it keeps rearing its head at different points. But he tells them to put away the foreign gods, which means some in that household had foreign gods. He says to purify yourselves, change your clothes, get clean, clean your body, clean yourselves. We're going in the presence of God. Get pure. So what's strange to me there is, why were there foreign gods allowed by Jacob at all? Why did they just go bury them? I don't know if this is the same ones that Rachel had taken and still there. Was there more than that? We only know what we know. But nonetheless, for some reason, instead of destroying those things, which may have been something that's awful to God, they just bury them at that point, almost like they're just can come back and get them at another time. So not sure if that's, you know, really the point or not, if he really was just burying them in the dirt, never to be taken out again. But why up to that point were they even there? You know, we don't know, and why that was allowed. It shouldn't have been. So he tells them that they're going to Bethel to build an altar there, and buries all that under that oak tree. So moving on from there, Jacob, and just a reminder here that his name has been changed to Israel already at this point, about to happen again, but Jacob, or Israel here, did not have to worry about the attacks from others as they traveled, because the terror of God was put on them. So that worry that he had back there shouldn't have been his main worry. Maybe he should have done more talking about the wrath and the unrighteousness of his sons just taking something too far. He was kind of worried about them being destroyed, but remember, there was blessings, and you got the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. He's in the line. God says, I'm going to be with you and take care of you. But the, you know, the human nature part of him is worried that he's going to be wiped out. But why are they not going to get wiped out, even though the other lands might have been angry and come after them? It says that God put this terror in the minds of those, and when they're coming through, people didn't want anything to do with them because they were afraid to touch them. So they arrive at Bethel, and he does what God instructed him to, and he builds an altar there and calls it El Bethel, or the God of Bethel, verse 7. And then it describes that this nurse of Rebecca died there in verse 8. And that she was buried under an oak tree. And the meaning behind that name that we read earlier, Alon Bakuth, where she was buried, that oak tree, they called it the Oak of Weeping, was that name. Okay, moving on there. So while they're still at Bethel and God's speaking to him, he tells him, your name shall be called Israel. This is the second time this is said. This is repeated from what we already studied in chapter 32. Once he wrestled with God at that point in that place, so he's being told, your name shall be called Israel. God tells him, I am God Almighty. Maybe there's some tying in that with these false gods, that God knows that they still have some of this, you know, some of these idols around and stuff that are just fake and offensive to God. But he said, I am God Almighty. He repeats the promises of the nation and land. He said, a great nation will come from you in verse 11. Repeats the land promise there in verse 12. I give you this land, which I gave to Abraham and Isaac. You know, we've been going through these promises and these blessings over and over now for the last several weeks. And he is being told this again. God is reassuring him, I am with you. These doubts that crop up in your mind every now and then, I am with you. I'm your God. Jacob sets up a pillar of stone there. And Jacob again calls the place Bethel, which we've already learned before is House of God. This is about 30 years or so after he was there the first time when he's about to flee. Remember, we talked about the 20 years in Haran, and then he comes back and the defilement would have been, you know, 7, 8, 9, who knows, 10 years after that point. So we're pushing about 30 years from when he was there the first time receiving those promises. Okay, down around verse 16, let's pick up a few verses there. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. So you see about where we were. They were in Bethel, and then they're heading south. We'll get to that. They're kind of making their way down to Hebron eventually there, but they're heading down through there, and they're coming through that area there, Bethlehem, Ephrath, as it's called, kind of getting close to that area where she dies and gives birth to Benjamin. So they leave there, and you know, as we just said, the names that was given, she calls Benjamin, she tries to name him Ben-Oni, which is son of my sorrow, but Jacob called him Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. So that's what takes place there. So she's buried. So we know we've been talking about the cave of Machpelah, where certain ones have been buried in the land that Abraham bought, that's not going to include Rachel. She's buried right here. So they leave that area after she dies and after Benjamin is born. They leave and journey towards a place called the Tower of Eder between Ephrath and Hebron, which is where they're heading to down there in verse 21. And then we get to this very sad couple of verses here where Reuben commits a great sin with Bilhah. It says down in verse 22 that he laid with Bilhah. This is Jacob's concubine, mother to his brothers Dan and Naphtali. Just as a side note, she would have only been around 15, maybe 20 years old when older than Reuben. He's probably 23 or 4 years old at this time. So you're talking about him being in his early 20s. She may be around 40 or so at this time. But as they left after Benjamin is born and go to this place, he goes into her when Jacob's not around or whatever, and he sneaks in there and commits this great sin. And it's going to cost him as well, speaking of chapter 49 and the blessings and all that Brent brought up. This is going to cost Reuben as well. But at this point right here, no punishment's recorded. Nothing is done to him that's recorded in this place. When Jacob hears of it, it does say he hears of it, but then that's kind of what it says. But in Genesis 49, this sin is what kept Jacob from giving Reuben, who was the firstborn, the birthright. So, and it's brought up at that point. We'll study that later. Then at the end of the getting to the end of the chapter, it kind of lists, now that Benjamin's born, it just lists all the sons of Leah, sons of Zilpah, sons of Rachel, sons of Bilhah, all those children now that have been born. You got the 12 sons here listed in those few verses. And then this comes to the conclusion of Isaac's life, verses 27 through 29. It says, "Then Jacob came to his father's house, to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. So Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him." So he's about 180. They've gone further south. They were going to visit him. When they get there, I guess he passes away at some point after they make it to him. Jacob and Esau would be about 120 years old now because Isaac was 60 when they were born. Now that he's 180, they would be 120. So that's about what their ages are at this time when they bury him. And although we're not told here, we're told in chapter 49 that in verse 31 that he was buried in the cave of Machpelah. That's all I have on chapter 35. Is there any comments or questions on chapter 35? That's a great point. Freddie's just bringing up the point when we were talking about why did Jacob allow there to be idols, or why at that point were there idols around? And Freddie brings up the point that, you know, they had just plundered Shechem, and maybe that's part of the plunder at that time. We're not really told, but, you know, quite possibly that could be how a lot of that and the earrings and all that that they were burying came from that plundering. Very good point. Anybody else? Okay, chapter 36, we're not spending really any time on. You could have read it on your own, or you can read it on your own, but it's pretty much the genealogy of Esau. Just a few points there. He took wives from Canaan. We talked about that before. It says that in verse 1 of 36. Takes all of his possessions and moves. Says the land wasn't going to be able to support all that he had accumulated and all that Jacob had accumulated, so they needed to be apart. Verse 7. And as we already knew, he moves to Mount Seir, and Esau is called Edom, it says. But as far as going to all the names, we're not going to spend any time on that. See, Mount Seir is way down there to the south, and some of our newer maps where we would say the land of Edom down there south of the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea. And you see where the story up in the top of the map, kind of where Jacob and his family had been moving down, all the way down where they get to Hebron where Isaac died. So that's all of that. All right, let's get into chapter 38. Just as a note, I had it on my earlier slide, but chapter 37 we're skipping because Wayne's going to get to that so that the story of Joseph kind of stays cohesive. So we'll be doing 37 and 39 later this week. So starting out chapter 38, Judah separates from his brothers, it says. He moves close to an Adullamite named Hira, who becomes his friend. He marries the daughter of Shua, who's a Canaanite. Judah has three sons through this daughter of Shua. His firstborn Ur, then Onan, then Shelah. Judah took Tamar as a wife for his firstborn Ur, it says in verse 6. Judah would have been around 40 or so at this time because he has children old enough to be married, right? So, you know, some of the stuff's not necessarily back-to-back, and this is another one of those because he has a son old enough to be married. He was about 20 when Joseph was sold, so this would have been after that time there. So just a side note on that. It says that Ur was wicked and God killed him in verse 7. No other details are given. It is what it is there. Down in verses 8 through 10, Judah goes to Onan and says, go into your brother, to your brother's wife, and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that that heir would not be his, and it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground lest he should give an heir to his brother, and the thing which he did displeased the Lord. Therefore, God killed him also. So Onan was to marry Tamar to raise up an heir for his brother who had died. He refuses to carry out his responsibility. It looks like he has no issue going into her, but he decides, I'm not letting her get pregnant because it's not going to be my heir. So his act of selfishness displeases God, and God kills him. So now Judah's first two, oldest two sons have both died because God killed them because they were considered wicked men by God. So moving on, Judah sends Tamar to her father's house and tells her to remain a widow. He says, I'll give you my other son, Shelah, but let him grow up first. But in his mind, we need to know from this story right here, he really doesn't want to do that. I guess he doesn't know what was recorded for us right there, that God had killed those two sons. because it's almost like he's thinking like she's like a black widow or something. So he's like, he says in his mind, you know, lest he also die like his brothers. He doesn't really want to give, it doesn't seem, give Sheila up to her at that time. So it's kind of built up to the story when he does get older, he doesn't come through. So eventually Judah's wife dies, and so he is a widower at this point. At verse 12, he goes to visit some sheep shears with his friend Hira at Timnah. In verse 13, Tamar hears of this trip, it describes there, and then she devises her own plan, it describes in verses 13 through 19, because Sheila obviously at some point in here got old enough, and Judah did not keep his word and did not give her his third son. And so she comes up with this plan. Let's see how we're doing on time. I don't really have time to go into great detail, but pretty much she saw that Sheila was grown, and she goes and dresses herself as a harlot on the way that he was. And when he comes by, he says, please let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She had a veil or whatever covering her. She asks for payment. He offers a young goat to her. And she pretty much says, what pledge? Or you don't have the goat now. What are you going to give me to hold so that I know that I'm going to get the goat? And he says, what do you want? And she said, your signet, cord, and staff that's in your hand. So he did so. And so she goes back and gets back home and kind of puts on her garments of her widowhood again. So I guess I should have made that point at the bottom of this slide here, that these items would be used to identify him later. So after she returns to her house, they go to try to make payment and give this goat away to her, but they can't find her. And all the men of the place there are saying, there's nobody here. That is a harlot. We don't know who you're talking about. So Judah pretty much kind of gives up on that and goes back. Well, 3 months later, word comes to them that Tamar's pregnant now. These describers playing the harlot and is pregnant. So Judah says, bring her out and let her be burned in verse 24. However, as we know what we just said about the signet, the cord, and the staff, Tamar comes out with that and says, by the man to whom these belong, I'm with child. So Judah acknowledges the items are his in verse 26 and says, she's more righteous than I. I did not give her Sheila. In other words, I broke my promise to her, so she acted more righteous than I. We need to know from that right there, neither one of them act righteousness, both acts obviously were unrighteous acts. Then twins were born to her, Perez, which means to make a breach, and Zerah. And even though that happened through Judah and his daughter-in-law, God's in control. And look at the genealogy given in Matthew 1, genealogy of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac, Isaac, Jacob, Jacob, Judah, and his brothers. Then Judah begat Perez and Zerah by Tamar. So it just kind of relates the story. It all kind of, you know, even though man constantly messes up, God is still in control. Quickly, some of the faith and failings. God's repeated promises to Jacob. Jacob worships God, and Isaac's faithful 180 years, not perfect, but faithful life to God. And then the failings, the revenge of Simeon and Levi, Jacob not destroying the idols, Reuben's sin with Bilhah, Judah's wicked sons, Er and Onan, and then Judah seeking to go into a harlot, and then Tamar deceiving Judah. All those right there are some failings that we can see where people weren't act right, and then some of the stories that we had in those chapters of people actually acting appropriately and showing faith in God. Next class is Wednesday, and if you want to read ahead, that's chapters 37 and 39. Thanks for your attention.